One of the things I loved about the Smiths songs was that there was rain in them. And it wasn't a romantic rain, it was just a wet rain. My name is Teddy Jameson, and I'm a journalist. In 1986, I do remember, I just graduated, and I was doing nothing with my life. I was unemployed, spending my days wandering around the town with nothing very much to do. I had no job, I had no prospects. I was living in a B&B at the time. The highlight of my day was going back to the digs and getting my meal, which I never liked, but it was a highlight anyway. I do remember one day I was sitting on a bench, end of a miserable day in a miserable summer, and a guy in his 20s maybe came along and was carrying a boombox. As he was approaching, I could hear the Smiths, and it was "There's a Light That Never Goes Out." Take me out tonight. I just remember just thinking, I'm not alone in this world. There are other people who have the same tastes, the same values as me. Projecting lots onto this guy I didn't know, but it just felt like a moment of connection. I didn't speak to him. Well, I was a Smiths fan. You don't talk to other people. No. I was far too shy to do that.
My name is Mike Garry and I'm a poet. I think the Smiths and their lyrics and their look and their sound were an echo of Manchester in the 80s. An echo of lots of northern cities of the 80s, dark, dreary, wet, ignored, unemployed. There wasn't a lot of opportunities, and a lot of it as well was a refusal to join in with society, with a Thatcherite society.
This multi-storey tower block is home to 90 families, and in a small area, the unemployment statistics can be frightening. We asked the local community worker how many of the tenants have a full-time job. The answer for this entire block is 5 people.
Some of the work that is being done is fantastically successful. Don't you think that's the way to persuade more companies to come to this region and get more jobs as I want them for the people who are unemployed? Not always standing there as moaning minis. Now stop it.
You sometimes get the feeling that the Prime Minister's definition of the enemy within has now been expanded to include most of the British people. We are all moaning minis now.
Because of the unemployment, it gave lots of people time. A lot of people had to sit in their bedrooms for long amounts of times. But from that came music.
The story of how the Smiths began, I think for me, is the greatest creation myth in pop music. Most songwriting partnerships, they form at school or through answering adverts in the back of magazines. That's the kind of traditional route. But the Smiths really is like a fairy tale. You have like young Johnny Marr, who's 18 years old, and he's this unfathomably gifted guitarist in Manchester, desperate to find a singer and lyricist equal to those gifts. And then suddenly he hears about Morrissey, Stephen Morrissey, who's reputed to be this reclusive genius, almost like, I mean, this being a fairy tale, almost like this Rapunzel character. He's trapped in his ivory council house in Stretford for months. You know, he really, really steps out, except under cover of darkness, to, you know, walk lonely streets and shake his fist at the stars, bewailing life's injustice. And then Johnny Marr basically becomes like the knight with a knight in shining arm, the knight with a shining guitar, who just suddenly turns up on his doorstep out of the blue, having heard about Morrissey, knocks on his door, and Morrissey opens it, and Johnny says, you know, let's start a group, let's write together, and that was it. That was the beginning of the Smiths. I'm Simon Goddard, and I'm an author and journalist, and I've written many, many words about the Smiths. One summer night in 1985, Morrissey went round to Johnny's house The way Johnny Marr remembers it is that he was sat on a coffee table. You know, what songs have you got? Well, I've got this one. So, you know, that song was born somewhere in the tight space between a coffee table and a settee.
I'm Andy Neil Mann. I work as a chauffeur. My relationship with my father was the typical very young child to older parents relationship. When I hit my teenage years, it was the standard teenage boy, elderly father, doesn't understand. It was a Saturday morning. I managed to miss my bus to go to work. My father and the rest of the family were preparing to go on holiday. My father very kindly offered to give me a lift to work. We got in the car and I said, "Oh, Dad, can I put some music on?" He never really understood my music. Never. And so the Smiths were playing in the background. I was actually willing for There Is a Light to come on. And I wanted to say, this guy sings about real life. Listen to what he has to say.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and the young and the light. Driving in your car, I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one anymore.
My dad, for the first time, gave me the indication that he recognised the genius that was the Smiths.
Because I want to see people and I want to see life.
He sat in the car and listened to the lyrics and nodded away, but not in beat with the tunes, with the lyrics that he agreed with.
Because it's not my home.
He sat there nodding at me and looking across, he was driving, and yeah, I understand that. Found the tent and crashed into us. Funny.
To die by your side, well, the pleasure, the privilege is mine.
I just really connected to my dad that day. Almost as if when you're born and your umbilical cord's cut, you sort of lose a connection with your mum. That day, I gained a connection with my dad. But 2 weeks later, my father was returning from his holiday with the family. And he had an aneurysm. Whilst I was at work, There Is a Light was playing on my headphones when my brother came flying in and pulled me away from work and told me, "We have to go to the hospital now." I jumped into the car and went to the hospital, and it was confirmed that my father had died on the operating table. I have a wave of emotion when I listen to the song, and it finishes off with a jaunty flute that makes me think of walking along a path with flowers either side. And it's happy. It's a happy song. And it just reminds me that There Is a Light never goes out. And for me, that's my dad.
They're not called the Smiths for nothing, because they wanted to be very real and very honest and very boy next door.
The Smiths were almost called Eyeless in Gaza, which is an Aldous Huxley book. But then they went to the opposite end and they decided that they wanted to be called the most common name in the world. What I loved about the Smiths was it was the first time a band had come along that I could recognise myself in the songs. I could recognise the kind of shyness, I could recognise the anxiousness, the nervousness, the uncertainty of your position in the world. I could recognise the sexual insecurity, all of these things I could recognise in the Smiths, and that was me. You know, before that I'd loved Bowie and things like that, but Bowie's an alien sex god. Morrissey felt like the bloke down the street. I mean, he was smarter than I was, but he was recognisable to me, and that was the kind of attraction of it.
The amount of people that Morrissey's words have inspired are incredible. Take Mark Gatiss, for example.
I was gay and sort of unable to really do much about it. I kind of fell for them straight away. And this song in particular has always been my favourite, and I think it's because it's a story song, for one thing. In my head, it's a bit like the gay version of the Beatles' She's Leaving Home. It's a young gay man running away from home because it's not his home anymore and driving off into the future.
The story in the song, I think the emotional core of it, is very ancient. I think it's that Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet thing, the suicide pact of two lovers seeking to escape the pain of the world around them. Even though Morrissey outdoes Shakespeare by the added tragedy that, you know, they're only lovers in his head or the head of its narrator. So it's got that extra, you know, that tragic element of it being this unconsummated fantasy.
The need to escape, even if, as many people do, they actually then move back home or even don't even very get very far, but to actually just change something. Whatever surrounds you at that age is not what you want.
The key line, it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more. And I think for a lot of us, it's Miss Apostles at the time. That was a coat hook upon which they hung themselves up on that song night and day.
Oh, please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more.
I've got another very, very vivid memory this time of going to a CND peace camp, yes. It was a sort of mini Woodstock for me. But I remember at the sort of closing disco, there was this boy I had a big crush on and who was actually dancing around the floor with, well, so, not exactly gladioli because he couldn't get any, but sort of, I think, daffodil stuffed down the back of his trousers, which is as close to Morrissey as you could get. He was Morrissey to me.
And in the dark and underpass, I thought, oh God, my chance has come at last.
And then a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask.
But a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask.
Take me out tonight. Oh, take me anywhere and I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired.
I also think it's about homosexuality. I'm not saying Morrissey was homosexual. I don't know what sex Morrissey was, to be honest. But I do think there's that sense of coming out within it as well.
He fudges whatever it is, whether it's a kiss or a... That's pure Morrissey, I think. It's a kind of upbeat song, which is then rather brought down by his own shyness and his inability to cope.
Many Smith songs have been interpreted lyrically as Morrissey's feelings towards Johnny Marr, primarily because it is true that Johnny and Morrissey, around the time the song was written, they did used to go on these massive long drives together. But for the record and on the record, Morrissey has stated that it isn't about him, so it's just up to the listener's romantic whim, really, to do whatever they want with that.
I'm Sharon, and I've got a little boy called Charlie. As a baby, he was very quiet. My mum always used to say, he doesn't look at you as a baby should. We thought he's going to be autistic at some point when, in about 18 months, he just wasn't interested in the same things that other children were interested in. He was interested in how Thomas's wheels went back and forward rather than Thomas meets Percy. And right on the nail, he was given a diagnosis of autism. And then when he was about 5, he started displaying signs of what the doctors thought. Well, they thought he was constipated. It was too difficult to examine him. So we got sent away with a sachet of Movicol when it was stage 4 cancer. I think we spent about 9 months in the hospital overall, and I basically felt like I didn't have a home anymore. The hospital was my home, and, you know, your child's got cancer, you now live in Manchester Children's Hospital. And that's where all my posts came. When he was going through chemotherapy at night, the doctors go home and the consultants aren't there. And so you're alone with the nurses and the other parents and children who are suffering. And it became this sort of tented community because all the you know, sheets round the side of the beds and you could hear soft murmurs and things like this. And it was quite nice to listen to the different languages of people talking to the different families. sharing food with them. It was fairly nice at night. However, that's when you have to deal with your thoughts. So you look out from your bed and you're looking at the lights of Manchester, and everybody's got a life apart from yours is stopping. Whilst he was going through chemotherapy, I always listened to music to get me through things like scans. I'd just switch my, iPod on. The particular song, There's a Light That Never Goes Out, the night I actually played that was a night that the registrar came to us, and after 2.5, 3 weeks of giving him blood products, 4 blood products every day, look, we're not getting anywhere with this, he's not responding. Really, it was an end-of-life talk. When the time comes, do you want to take him home or do you want it to be in hospital? And I was so repulsed and angry about that conversation that actually occurred. Being in the room with him that night after speaking to the registrar and really the end-of-life talk, I happened to play that particular song, and I'm pretty sure when Morrissey wrote it, he didn't ever think, a mum sitting in a paediatric cancer ward would get anything out of it. But to me, A, you've got the lyrics, they're quite melancholy. Oddly enough, like Johnny Marr's guitar is always quite upbeat if you listen to it, all the way through, it's very driven. And that's the bit really that, you wanted something to give you energy, and I got an awful lot from that song. So, yeah. At the end of the song, being repeating over and over, there is a light that never goes out, and it's almost like a chant. And to me, it was almost quite hypnotic, and I used to start, chanting along to it. And I think even I'd heard Morrissey said something about, there is a light that never goes out is what we tell ourselves to keep ourselves going, because in actual fact it is a bit crap, isn't it? Terrible things do happen. People die, children die of terrible diseases. I was thinking, God, this is going to happen. I'm going to be one of those people left behind without a child. After that song, I felt really calm, but totally full of energy. I was really buzzing. I was just looked at him in his bed. He was so peaceful and just my Charlie, and I just wanted to. It was instinct, really, just to start to put my hands on it. It wasn't even stroking him, really. I was just placing them lightly on him all over his body. Just like you do with your child, you cherish them and every bit of him. And saying things, I can remember saying things like, come on, Charlie, come on, Charlie. And I could feel this burning in my hands. If I listened to this, I would say, oh, my God, she's off a rocker. But literally, this was probably the closest I've ever been to a religious experience. And I really felt that before I listened to that song, it looked as though, like death was looking on through the window. This was going to happen. And the next day, the doctors actually came round and said, Mom, this is the first day we've ever seen any improvement. And from there, he went straight up and got better again. And thank you, Morrissey. Now Charlie's in remission and he's 2 years away from it. If you look at textbooks, you speak to doctors, neuroblastoma's not got a good case of long-term survival, stage 4. But someone's got to do it. Why not Charlie? I do feel like I've dragged him out from it. Big world, isn't it? Things happen, magical things happen.
It's a song about perpetuity, the perpetual light, which is a theme which runs through most religions. He talks about God. He talks about heaven. He talks about death, the ultimate, and an acceptance of it, an acceptance that if a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. I find it incredibly spiritual. I find it incredibly religious. In lots of ways, it's a prayer. his recent declaration that he had cancer, and if I die, so what? Echoing, there is a light that never goes out in lots of ways. If a tent on drop kills the both of us, to die by yours, it doesn't really matter. It's like this part of our existence is almost unimportant. There are bigger things, and there is hope.
My name is Lucy Nicely. I'm a comic book author, artist, and I live in Chicago. When I was about 20, I met my boyfriend online, as most people do these days. John and I had arranged to meet when I rode up on my bike and he was standing there in his shorts and black Argyle socks pulled up to nearly his knees with sneakers and a plaid shirt. I thought, who is this nerd? He's adorable. Of course, it was a lovely date and I completely fell for him. But he never wanted to have kids, and eventually I sort of wanted to go in that direction. So when we hit the five-year mark and he was thinking about going to grad school, at that point we sort of reassessed and said, well, if this is not going in the same direction, perhaps this is a good stopping point. So we split up. I moved to New York for a period of time, and the Smiths played a pretty big role musically for me at this time. I feel like the Smiths are sort of the anthem of breakups. And throughout this period, you know, I was obviously still in love with him, and I would listen to the Smiths alone in my apartment. I'd listen to A Light That Never Goes Out. I always really enjoyed the end of the song, the sort of fading out, the light that never goes out, repeated and repeated, as sort of the ambiguous end to the song as to what was going to happen between the singer and the person that they are singing to in the song. This idea that he loves so completely with no sort of evidence of requiting that love on the other side. We were very lucky, though, that we were still friends and we talk on the phone and email, and he would come visit or I would go to visit him. About a little over a year ago, he came to my tiny apartment in New York. We decided to go to a beer garden in Queens, and I was starting to come to the conclusion that seeing him so often was not a good idea, that remaining friends with this person that I was so in love with still was not a good idea, and it was not helping me to date other people or to try and find love again. So we were riding the subway to Queens. He turned to me and he said, "Aren't these weekends so nice together? It's like this break from everyday life." And my response to this, of course, was to burst into crazy tears and to cry for the continuous 45-minute train ride, noisily and wetly, to which he had basically no response other than abject horror. I wanted these trips together, this time that we would spend together, to not be a break from everyday life. I wanted it to be everyday life. So we get back to my apartment and I'm done for the evening. I put on my ugly pajamas and wash my face and brush my teeth and get ready for bed. And he says, still in all of his clothes, "Hey, could I talk to you for a second?" So we sat on the couch and I was sort of balled up in my protective ball, expecting him to sort of call it off and say, "We shouldn't see each other anymore. This is too hard." But instead, he pulled out a ring saying, "You know, I've reevaluated. I want to have kids with you. I want to have a family. And, you know, at this point, I don't think that we're sort of dating material anymore. If we've lasted 3 years and we're still in love with each other." I remember sort of saying, "All right, I think that we should go to bed and think about this and talk more in the morning, because I don't even know how to respond to this." It was such a shock. That he said, "Okay, all right, let's put the ring someplace neutral." So we put it on my TV antenna for the evening and we went to bed. And I remember, like, a few hours later, I couldn't sleep and I got up and sort of took it off the antenna and put it on and looked at it and took it off my finger and put it back on the antenna and went to bed. And then a few hours later, getting up again and taking it off the antenna and putting it on my finger and looking at it and taking it off and putting it back on and going to bed. And by the next morning, I was wearing the ring. We got married in my mother's backyard in upstate New York. She has a beautiful sort of timber frame barn that she uses for woodworking purposes. And it has a beautiful tin roof. And, you know, we kept the guest list pretty small, about 100 people. And then, of course, the one day of the entire September, it poured rain on our wedding day. You know, I put on my Wellington boots and tromped down to the barn. And as people were filing into this beautiful wooden timber frame barn, we could hear The Light That Never Goes Out playing into the sort of echoing timber frame space. The sounds of our family and friends kind of gathering and murmuring and discussing, combined with the sound of the rain hitting the tin roof, was really beautiful. So it was kind of this moment of peace and tranquility. I've been making comics for 10 years about my life and sharing them with people and readers. And so I had to think about how to tell people that have been following my life and my sort of dating mishaps and who knew who John was through my work, how to explain what had happened to them. So I made a comic and I titled it There's a Light That Never Goes Out, which I named after the Smith song that had meant so much to me during the breakup and how meaningful it had been to sort of have this symbol of hope that never dies, that this love and this yearning that kind of can last through distance and time with no hope, it remains.
No matter what state of mind you are in, no matter what you are thinking or feeling, there is a sense of hope. And I think that's what the tune taps into really, really well and says, listen, no matter how down you are or no matter how desperate you are, there is a light that never goes out and you will find it.